Hello, Discover Freedom podcast listeners and viewers. I'm really excited to introduce you to my guest today. I have Meredith Boggs with me, and we are going to talk about a lot of fun stuff. Meredith lives in Nashville, Tennessee, which we are actually kind of neighbors now. I'm new to Tennessee.
Cool. We're not far. Nice.
Yeah, so Chattanooga, just a couple hours away. And also, she's a wife and a mother, but she is a podcaster. She's an author. And okay, let me see if I get this right. She is a critical care and sexual assault forensic nurse.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, which is a mouthful, and I'd love to hear more about that. Before we get started, tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Yes. So, I mean, those are kind of the biggest highlights. I'm a born and raised Nashville girl. So yeah, Tennessee is home. Lived abroad for a little while and traveled all over. I love to travel, but Tennessee is home. I'm married. I've been married for about 10 years. And we have a little boy named Jack. He is 18 months. So he is a wild man and keeps on our toes. And then we are due with baby number two in March of 23. So so very exciting. Lots, thank you. Lots going on. I am a writer. I have my first book coming out in January, which is exciting. And then also I've been, it's funny in the like author and podcast world, it's kind of like my whole like identity as a nurse is kind of forgotten or falls by the wayside, but I've been a nurse for 10 years. I work here in Nashville for Lifelight. So as a critical care transport nurse, and then also as a forensic nurse examiner, I take call on the weekends and, help patients that have been in really terrible situations. So, it's one of those lines of work that I hate that there is even a need for my job. Yeah. I wish that we lived in a world that a lot of our jobs were not needed, but I'm really thankful to get to do that work. And it uses a really different part of my brain than writing and podcasting does. Sure. And so, yeah, it's a different skill set. But there, you know, it's interesting. There is more overlap than you would think in some of it, especially like, you know, just communication, talking with people. And so, yeah, so that's just a little bit about me.
Wow. Well, you stay busy for sure.
Yes.
Especially with the little one.
Oh my gosh.
But I remember those days. Never a dull moment.
No. Never. It's never dull. My, this week, you know, and you'll probably remember this from having young children. It's like one day they can't do something and then the next day they can. And you're like, oh my gosh, we got to baby proof the house.
Yeah.
My son this week figured out how to unlock the back door and let himself out. So,
Nice.
You know, have spent the week, installing, you know, all these things to baby proof it so that he can't let himself outside.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I lost him for about 5 minutes and was like, okay, well, that took 5 years off of my life while I was trying to figure out where he went.
Oh my gosh.
In a house with a toddler when it gets too quiet that something bad is happening. So,
yes.
Turns out he was just outside playing by himself.
Well, I wish I could tell you that things get simpler and less scary.
they don't. It's just a new level.
Exactly. So, every season has its new challenges, but it's also worth it.
Oh, it's good to hear.
Yeah. Do you know what you're having next?
No, we'll find out in a couple weeks.
Okay. Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Very cool. So tell us how you got into the Enneagram. How did that start fitting into your life and what you do?
Yes, that's a great question. I actually was introduced to the Enneagram in high school. I was in counseling in high school and at the time for an eating disorder. And that was part of the framework that this particular counseling group used to help their clients. We also used it in our group setting. So I was probably 15 when I first learned about it. And this is kind of like the caveat I tell people. I'm like, tests are helpful, but they can be wrong because I tested as a one, which is not surprising because it's like I was in treatment for an eating disorder. So all those behaviors were very front and center, but I'm a type eight. And so when you dive into the motivations, the core emotions, the fears, the desires, like that's where your type is really, really emerges from. So I was introduced to it then and no one knew what it was. That was back in like the early 2000s. People were like, what is that?
So nobody
knew what it was. But it was always really helpful in understanding myself and then even going to college, understanding other people and just being exposed to a whole new world. And then it was probably in my mid 20s when it really reemerged. The Road Back to You came out. A lot of other people started talking about it. That's when I probably did like my real deep dive into it. Used it again during counseling at the time. Started studying it myself. Took a course with, there's a lot of, you know, as you know, ways to get certified or learn the Enneagram.
Yes.
But I was really interested in more of the clinical side, and that's probably because of my background in healthcare. But I did some training through the Union Institute and University. Helen Palmer was instrumental in creating that curriculum. And it was bonus because I actually got CEs that I got to use for my nursing license.
That's
for
awesome.
It. So it was fun. It was fun. It was like, oh, this is work, but it's fun. So yeah. So, and then, you know, it's been part of what I write about, what I speak about. My husband and I talked about it a lot on our podcast, and I joke with people, I never really planned to write a book about the Enneagram, and here it is. It's my first book coming out. So it's just kind of funny the way that God's like just orchestrates things.
Yeah.
I had been a writer and blogger and was pursuing this dream of getting published. But this is the idea that stuck, and that publishers were like, yeah, that's what people want to know about. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you mentioned you're an eight. I was going to talk to you about that too. How did you go from testing as a one? And I agree with you. I always tell people, don't trust the test.
Yeah.
It's a good starting point, but you have to dive deeper. So how did you go from that to discovering that you're an eight?
So my counselor at the time, she had the Enneagram Made Easy book. And she let me take it home and read it. And I read the chapter on a one, and I was like, yeah, cool, that makes sense, whatever. And I read the chapter on an eight, and I was like, oh no, this is it. So it was like, it was very apparent. It was like, oh yeah, no, this is, I'm not motivated by the same thing that ones are. And like, I don't share that same core fear. But what was there about an eight, it was like, oh no, like how does somebody know this about
right.
me? So yeah, that's really, I figured it out relatively quickly, just reading that book. But, I do think I probably had the advantage of stumbling across it when I was younger. I think the older that you get and the more, you know, just life that you've lived, adaptive strategies that you've learned, it's, I think it is harder, to pin down your type.
For sure.
So,
yeah. And I know working with clients that is very true. It definitely takes more work to kind of peel back the layers and try to remember things and how you were when you were just kind of coming into yourself. And yeah, it takes a lot of work for sure.
Yeah.
That's great. So this could be a whole podcast episode in itself, but I would love for you to speak just a couple minutes to being a woman eight. I've talked to other eights. And I just think it doesn't happen a lot that I get to interview eights that are women. And so if you have any words of encouragement or something that you've learned that would be helpful to other people that either are an eight or people that know a woman eight or have one in their life.
Yeah. You know, I think they talk about this in The Road Back to You, that eights can be some of the most misunderstood types, particularly females. And I do think that that's true. And I think you can do two things with it. You can use that as a crutch and be like, oh, no one understands me. Or you can use that as a way to kind of say, okay, so how do I work within I like to think of it as like a creative limitation. You know, that's how like deadlines are. It's like you have this deadline and you have, you know, I landed my book deal. I got a call the month after my son was born that they wanted to publish this book. And I was like, okay, this was not the plan, but great.
Right.
And so for me, it was like working towards this deadline with the creative limitation of this newborn that needed to be nursed every 2.5 hours. And when I wasn't sleeping through the night. So looking at things that could be barriers or obstacles as more of like a creative challenge, like how do I, you know, operate with this? So I've tried to shift that mindset into like, how do I show up in the world? How do I interact with other people? Knowing that is the case, that I can be misunderstood, but not using that as like a crutch or as kind of an excuse for my behavior. I think too, Anne Lamott, she wrote this in Bird by Bird. It was not even about the Enneagram, but she has this quote and it says, you don't always have to chop with the sword of truth. You can also point with it. And to me, that just feels very fitting for an eight, that
that's good.
Feel like the truth, like we have to state it and it has to like be said and be heard and it has to be the driving force. But also realizing that we can just point with it too. And people will get it and they will hear it. I think those two things have been really helpful for me as a female eight. And I'll say this too, I do have the advantage, I think, of working in a profession where I work in very critical emergency situations where direct communication is like, you have to communicate that way or someone will die. And where people don't get their feelings hurt because you are all working towards the same goal. And it's not, interpersonal dynamics are important, but I do think I have that a little bit easier than, some people that work in
For
other
sure.
professions as female aides. But even over the years, it has really helped me grow in how do I communicate best with my partner that is a very different type and communicates differently. And so, so I would say those two big things right off
That's
the
good. That's an amazing quote. I'm going to have to use that again
It's really
later.
It's funny.
But
It's
I love that because when you have a healthy eight, which has just this inborn ability for leadership, if you have a healthy eight, all they have to do is point forward. They don't have to even speak sometimes, and people follow because you look to a healthy eight and you just see that ability and that strength. And a lot of other people that maybe don't have those same strengths, they will easily fall in line and join that, whatever that cause is or whatever the project is, because they see this healthy eight taking the charge, taking the lead, and not having to kind of tear down other people in order to move forward with that project. So I think that that's great. I love that.
They're not, if they're able to point instead of chopping, it's one of those examples where they're not bulldozing people or other things out of the way. Like you said, they're just pointing and people are following. So,
No, that's great. That's great. So I don't, my following, not everyone is, it comes from a faith-based background. So I'm excited when I am able to have a faith-based conversation with someone about the Enneagram. And so, as you mentioned, you have a book coming out. Is it January?
Yeah, January.
Okay, in January. And so I want to hear more about your book. I want you to explain to us where the idea came from, what the plan is with it. And it's called The Journey Home.
Yep, that's it.
Yeah, so where did this idea come from? Tell us more about it.
Yes, so it's the title's The Journey Home, and it's a biblical guide to using the Enneagram to deepen your faith and relationships, kind of a long subtitle. I really where it came from was this time in my mid-20s when the Enneagram reemerged. I was back doing some counseling. My husband and I had lived abroad for a little while, and we're just kind of in a phase that is like, I need some tools in my tool belt. And the Enneagram was part, again, we started using the Enneagram in counseling, and it was really helpful. But even in doing work and just reading on my own and some personal growth, there just wasn't a lot in the spiritual growth space that felt accessible. A lot of it felt very cerebral and kind of just like a little bit more like theory based than practical. And so that was really it for me. It was like, okay, how do I integrate this into my spiritual life and spiritual practice and my faith every day? And I'll say too, a little bit, who this book is written for is it's kind of two people within the faith-based arena. It's for Christians who are like, ooh, I think the Enneagram's cool, but I'm also skeptical because I've heard some things about the origins. I don't know as a Christian if I should even like dive into this. I don't know. So it's for them. And it's also for people that are kind of on the spiritual fringes. There's been a huge exodus from the church collectively, and the pandemic obviously played a huge part in that. But I think people too are just, as they come into adulthood, are examining parts of the way they grew up and systems and beliefs that they've always subscribed to. And they're asking questions of like, do I really believe that? Do I subscribe to that? And people are finding themselves in a place that maybe, maybe on one end of the spectrum, they were in that some kind of spiritually abusive situation that was very terrible. And then maybe they were in a place that it was like, no, there was nothing like evil or malicious, but it just wasn't, now as they've grown into their own, they're just kind of like, I still love God and I still believe in him, but just feeling kind of disconnected. And like they're looking for a way to revitalize their faith. And so it's really kind of written for those people that are spiritually on the fringes that have found this really deep resonance with the Enneagram and learning about themselves and other people and are asking, how do I integrate this into my spiritual life? So that's kind of who it's written for. And that's really, it's very simple in the format. It's kind of, I tell people like it's a primer. It's not really deep. Anyone that studied the Enneagram, as you know, like it's just endless in terms of its layers and levels. But each chapter, there's a couple introduction chapters, one that we do a deep dive into the origins of the Enneagram. And then there's a chapter on each type. And in each chapter, we walk through a little brief overview about the type. We talk about the core emotion of that type. We talk about the sin tendency, the virtue, and then how to grow spiritually. What does that look like practically? Right. So, yeah, so that's a little bit about it.
Very good. I can't wait to get a copy and read more. I think you're completely correct too, in that, I mean, there has become more and more available with the Enneagram, but I think people really do just want to get their hands on something practical. And I love that you've tied it into how does this practicality look like in my Christian walk, in my walk with God. And that also it can be something that might encourage people to continue to incorporate that, or maybe to come back to that in their life. Yeah. So I think that that's great. And you mentioned a couple things. One of them reminds me of how one of my favorite things about the Enneagram is the growth path that it offers to us. And that it's kind of different in that way. It doesn't just label us or give us this title. We have enough labels nowadays. We need more than just the label. We need to know, okay, what do I do with this label? And the Enneagram does that. It gives us this path of what do I do next? How do I grow? How do I strengthen the things that I can shine in? How do I let go of the things that are weaknesses? And so talk to us, and I don't know if you go into this in your book, but talk to us, how can we foster that growth for each type? Are there practical steps that you can kind of, any bullet points you can give us today?
Yes. Let me see real quick. Let me see if I can pull up some notes. I've done several interviews and questions are like, they kind of all overlap, but they can also be a little bit different. I think when it comes to like the spiritual growth side specifically, and I think in anything in life, it's really easy to focus in on the negative, what's wrong, what, you know, system is broken, what needs to be fixed. But when we can focus on strengths and areas that we're already gifted in, that gives you so much momentum in moving forward. And so I think that my favorite part of writing this book was really writing about the virtue of each type. And you know, this is the case, the Enneagram is so dynamic, and we are as humans that it's like all the sin tendencies, we all struggle with them. We all, the sin proclivity of a type 2, type 3, type 7, even though that's not my type, it's like, yeah, I see where that emerges in my life. But the one that's specific to your type tends to be the one that it's like, that one pops up more. And the same with the virtues is like, you look at the different virtues of each type and it's like, that's what I have the potential to be and to grow into. And so it's really beautiful to see them model. But I think in terms of like something really practical, I do actually have it. I do break it down a little bit more into each section, but I think for the type ones, when you have seen, and feel free to speak into this too, with any of your clients or people, I think for type ones, their virtue is perfection, which they're all like, yes, please, like make the world perfect. But it's not in a way, that it's like this rigidness. It comes through serenity. It comes from serenity and it comes through surrender. So it's when ones can get to this place where this in-between time that we're living in that's imperfect is okay while we wait for the second coming of Jesus and surrendering to that, that is perfection until like the end when it is true perfection. Right. And when you can see a one live from that state of surrender rather than rigid black, white, good and bad, it really gives the rest of us hope. So I think that's beautiful about a one. The type two, their virtue is humility. And type twos, they truly are, like you think of them, they're just the definition of servants when they're doing it from an altruistic place. And you know, and some of these have their counterpart of their sin tendency. And for the type two, their sin tendency is pride. And that one's interesting for the two. And I don't think often pops up in the way that we traditionally think of pride. But it can pop up in this place of believing, oh, I know what this person needs, or I know how to meet this need. And maybe that's not what that person needs or wants. And maybe they're not the person to meet it. And so when they can humble themselves in front of God and other people and saying like, I'm truly here as a vessel to be used. That is so beautiful. And that's when true service emerges.
Good.
Tell me, what type are you, Mitzi?
I'm a one.
You're one. Okay.
Yes. You nailed it.
Okay. I was going to say, anything else that you would add to a one?
Well, I mean, you said it perfectly. And I think, and you also kind of gave the introduction perfectly. It's like, I can see it, all of these different, you call them sin tendencies. I tend to call them central weaknesses. Yeah. Or they're also known as passions, but you can see how each of them can pop up in your life.
Yeah.
But then you look at the one that's dominant for your type, and you kind of can see that filter into almost every area of your life.
Yeah.
And so, yes, for the one, it's anger. And that's definitely for the one, it's kind of that frustration, that being rigid, that resentment. It's not always this explosive anger that you would expect in anger. And so having to relax that and to find that peace and the word serenity is key there, because it's not the norm for a one.
Yeah.
And so for me to let that go and to it, also another word that's very, I guess, can describe a one in their, just their MO would be tense. Just there's just this tension all the time. And so I know that in my home, when my husband and my kids find me in that place of serenity and relaxation, it's like a party around the house. Everyone's like, yes.
You're like, yeah, Mom.
We don't know what happened, but let's stay right here for a while.
I like it.
But yeah, so just, I love how, and I actually, in on Instagram, I joined with a friend of mine. His account is all in Spanish, but he's an artist. Oh, cool. I'll have to give you the tag later because his art, his Enneagram art is amazing. And we are doing right now, we're doing passions and virtues. And so I think when this episode comes out, we would have just finished. But just talking about how they're the exact flip side of each other, you know, and they counteract each other.
Yes.
And so when you find yourself operating in that sin tendency and you have this awareness of the Enneagram and this knowledge of the Enneagram, then you know where you can pinpoint and say, okay, there's a flip side to this. And for me, that flip side is serenity, which is not my norm, but I know that it's like this, it's almost like the optimal growth for me. It's like, you know, there's with the Enneagram, there's so many steps of growth and so many levels of development, but that virtue is almost like, this is like the perfection of who I could be.
It's like the pinnacle.
Yes, exactly.
I love that. And you bring up a really good point. I should have touched on this earlier, but within the Enneagram, based on like the teacher, the book you're reading, whoever, there's a lot of interchangeable language.
Yes.
And so obviously my book is more, you know, spiritually inclined. So we talked about sin, tendency, and virtue, but passion, fixation, I love central weakness. That is like the perfect description. Because some of these, I don't know, some of these things ride the line too, that it's like things that pop up in our life, they may not be explicitly sinful, but it's like, but they're not the most helpful to our becoming and our growing. So
exactly.
I'll say that as a caveat too, that you might hear different terminology used, but it all kind of overlaps.
Yeah, that's right.
So the type three, their virtue is hope. And this one is so beautiful to me. I have a lot of threes in my life. And for a three, if you've ever watched them, their sin tendency that they struggle with is deceit. And it's not from this, again, most of these sin tendencies, they're not from this overtly evil and malicious place. It's from this place of it's like when you get into it, it really brings a lot of compassion in for them. But for threes, it's this core belief that who they are is not good enough aside from what they accomplish. And so they spend their whole life achieving and accomplishing to earn this approval. And so for them, they really, when they step into this authentic place of believing that who they are is good enough and the work of the cross was sufficient and that they don't have to keep accomplishing and doing, that gives so much hope to the rest of us that it's like, if threes can step off their stage of performance and accept the love that's been lavished on them, that gives so much hope to the rest of us. So that one, I think, is really beautiful.
That is good. And can I say something to that too?
Yeah.
Because you said about the two, and it's the same with the three. The two, you know, they hear pride, and they think, but I'm not a prideful person. I'm constantly giving. And the two, and the three also deceit. They're like, but I'm not a liar. Like, I'm not. And so it's good to understand, and you explained it perfectly with the two also. But the three, it's like, it's not that they're walking around lying about everything that they do, but it's that who they are, and they have so many masks that they're constantly interchanging. And so with a three, they can do that so much that they can even deceive themselves into who they actually are, and kind of forget who they were meant to be and who that true person inside of them is. So that's where that deceit comes from.
Yes, I love that. Also, please, I was going to say, please interject and jump in on any of these, because I think this is best when this is how the Enneagram is learned best, and this is how people identify with it most, through conversations, through interaction. And you know this too from Enneagram, that so much of it was an oral tradition. That's how it was taught. That's how it was passed down. And that's, you know, really such a great way to learn it. So the type four, their virtue is origin. And that one is very weird and out there. And it's so fitting for the type four, because they're just these, that's just who they are. They're so unique. They're so different out there. But their sin tendency is envy. And fours have this really interesting duality where they want to be like other people. And so there's this envy that they're not like them, but then they want to be different. They don't want to be compared to other people. And so that's kind of where the envy piece slips in. It's like, they want to be the same, but they don't want to be too much the same. Then they want to be different. And this piece, this virtue of origin, really goes back to the Garden of Eden and creation, that it's like everything that was created good. And fours are, what I love about fours is that they can witness pain and not have to, you know, fix it. They don't have to medicate it. They don't have to like say all the dumb things that the rest of us say when we're uncomfortable with pain. They just can bear witness to it. But because of that, they feel like the brokenness and the pain on such a deep, gut-wrenching level that, you know, for them, again, kind of like the ones, it's like living in this in-between time of like the garden and creation, and now like post-fall world before the second coming of Christ, when everything is ultimately made new and set right. It's so painstaking for them. But this virtue of origin, that it's like, you will, like, we have been made new. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the gospel, that it's like it has been accomplished and it is being accomplished in us. But it's like you have been created perfectly and wonderfully and beautifully, and you are being created into that. Yeah. And it's going to be even better because of the redemption that happens. And it's something that like our minds can't really understand, that it's like, but how could something that's broken actually be more beautiful than it was originally created? But that's the goodness of it, that it's like something in its redeemed state is that beautiful. And so I think of in the Bible, when it talks about from glory to glory, I just picture fours, that it's like, yes, from glory to glory for them. And that is really that virtue of origin that emerges. Do you have anything else to add?
No, I love that. I have several fours very close in my life. And sometimes it's hard to watch because they do have that. It's like there's this constant feeling that something's missing for me, which can bring them quickly to that envy. But at the same time, like you said, they also have this desire to be different, and they're really good at being authentic. And so being around fours, it helps others to relax. And to realize, oh, I can just be myself. I don't have to try to be something that I'm not, especially.
And they don't want you to be someone else.
So they have that gift. And so when they can realize that there's nothing missing about them, they are who they are, and they're perfectly made as they are. And then they can walk out in that authenticity. It's amazing. It's an amazing
thing. Really is. It's beautiful. In talking through all these types, I'm picturing friends and family members and people that when you see them walking that out, it's just so beautiful. And it's a picture of Christ to the rest of us. So type five, their virtue is transparency. Their sin tendency is avarice. And that's just kind of another word for greed. And it's not even greed. I think the biggest thing with five is it's not greed in the monetary sense, but it is this kind of hoarding of resources, of their time, of their energy, of their intellect, out of fear that they don't want to be without. They don't want to be left stranded without resources and support. And so for fives, this virtue of transparency or open-handedness is this belief that unsubscribing to the scarcity mindset, there is enough, Christ is enough, and his sufficiency is ultimately what they rely on instead of their own self-sufficiency. I have a few fives in my life, and it's like when you see that from them, you're just like, oh my gosh, it's so beautiful.
Yes, it totally is. I love that.
So type sixes, their virtue is faith, and their sin tendency is fear. And I think this is really important to touch on, kind of like with ones, their sin tendency is anger, and it can get really gray when you have a sin tendency that's an emotion, because emotions are not sinful. Right. They are a normal human, they're part of the human experience. Yeah. But it's so much of how we choose to respond and react out of those emotions that can be constructive and helpful or be really destructive. And for sixes, when they can step into this place of faith in spite of their fear and choosing to act instead of being controlled by this worry and this anxiety over all the what ifs of what could potentially happen, it gives the rest of us a pathway to walk forward to in faith. What Hebrews 11:1 talks about, faith in what is unseen, and that conviction of who God is in the midst of all of it. And so I love that. My sixes really are the ones in my life that challenge me, that it's like, oh, this is where you need to step into faith, instead of relying on your own self-sufficiency, or instead of playing the what if game in your head, which is like, you know, not very helpful after a while. So that's it for type sixes. Type sevens, their virtue is wisdom, and their kind of their countering one, their sin tendency is gluttony. So sevens, they can live in this perpetual state of kind of planning the next activity, the next thing, out of fear of pain. It's not always physical pain for sevens. It can be emotional pain or just feeling stuck. Sevens are kind of the notorious like job hoppers. They're like the quintessential like entrepreneurs. They're always doing something new. They got to keep their options open, and they've got to have the choices. But for sevens, this virtue emerges, this wisdom emerges when they're able to really be still in whatever their circumstance, even if it's not something acutely painful, because their fear is, but what if I get stuck here? And what if it is painful? The fact of the matter is that sevens, like, they're really strong, and they have the ability to survive really hard things. I have a really good friend who is a seven, and over the last couple of years has just walked through some really deeply painful seasons that, like, if you had told her that at 25, she would have been like, no, I'm out. Can't do this. Tag me out. And watching the wisdom that has emerged from her, I mean, it's truly like she's a different person than the girl I met when we were 25. So that's just really, it's really beautiful for sevens when they can step into that place. It comes from a real sobriety, and it's not a sobriety from substances, but this, just this steadiness in their state of mind and the way that they approach life, and relationships and other things. It's a very metered way of living instead of kind of like here and there and everywhere. So that's the type seven. The type eight, their virtue is truth. Their sin tendency is lust. And so for eights, again, similar to fives with avarice, eights lust is not lust in the typical sense that we think of, in the sexual sense, but it's just this unbridled too muchness that they approach with. It's the chopping with the sword of truth instead of just choosing to point with
it. It's a lust for life.
It's a lust for life. And their virtue, again, kind of like we talked about, it's like when they can just simply point with that sort of truth, people will follow. They can just point with them. They don't even have to say anything. And people will follow, because it's not about the eight. It's not about their agenda. It's about what is true and what is right. And they do have that somewhat paralleled with a one, that you never have to worry that something for a one is self-serving. It's it's what's right, it's what's good. Right. They are high integrity, high moral people, and so you don't have to worry with ones. And eights are similar in that sense, that it's about the truth at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's good.
And then finally, for the type nine, their virtue is love, and that one's really beautiful too. Some Enneagram teachers will talk about the nine sits at the top of the Enneagram, and they have this cardinal view of all the other types, which makes them so empathetic. It makes them truly able to understand and see all the other types. But for them, this is really, really powerful, because their sin tendency is sloth, and they can kind of slip into this place of being self-forgetting, and in an effort to not create or have to deal with internal or external conflict, they neglect the work that's set before them. And a lot of times, love, true love in our relationships, emerges through difficult conversations. It emerges through actions that could create internal or external conflict. And so when nines are able to do that, it really is love in action, which is true love. So
that's good. That's good. And for the nine too, I always like to point out that it's not just action, it's right action.
Yes.
Sometimes nines can be very active,
but not with the right things. That is a good point. Yeah.
And so a friend of mine that's a nine and an Enneagram coach, I don't know how long ago, she was like, you know what? She started talking to me about right action. And I was like, I'm always going to use that, because that's true.
Yes.
Because they can say, oh, I'm very active, I'm always doing something, which can be true. But a lot of times it's not what needs to be done.
Yeah. That's a really, really good point with the nine.
Yeah, that's good. So before we wrap up, we've talked about this growth, individual growth that we can find, personal growth that we can find through the Enneagram. But you mentioned that your book also touches on relationships.
Yeah.
So what can you tell us just kind of give us a teaser so we go out and get your book in January. But how do you touch on relationships in your book, and how can the Enneagram help us in our relationships with others?
Yeah, I think the biggest overarching theme is compassion, that it's like when you understand someone else's struggles, their sin tendencies, or their central weaknesses, when you understand the core beliefs or the fears, the emotions that really are the first ones to pop up for them, instead of getting really frustrated, it gives you a lot of compassion. And I'll use this example I have a lot of type ones in my life. I have a lot of friends. I have a sister that's a type one. And even as an eight, sometimes I would get really, like, I would get my feelings hurt, or I would get really offended by something that they said. And I'd be like, dang, you don't have to be so critical. And when I finally, the thing that was so helpful about the Enneagram is when I understood how intense and how harsh their own inner critic is, and how anything that anyone else feels is just a fraction of that, I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, they like broke my heart. It was like, I cannot believe what they live with on a daily basis of having, we all have an internal critic, but you know, some of us, you know, it's really not that harsh. And some of us, you know, are just like, shut up, go away. But with ones, just understanding that, it gave me so much compassion. And so now anytime a one says something that might, you know, rub me the wrong way or come across just slightly critical, it's a lot easier for me to just kind of like let it go and be like, one, that wasn't personal. Two, you know, and really step into this place of compassion for them. And
so
I think when you understand that from other people, it really just changes everything in terms of your dynamic. You don't think people are like the bad guy. They're not out to get you. They really struggle uniquely in this way. And then I think also too, on the flip side, watching people step, like when nines step into right action, and when, you know, sixes step into faith instead of fear, it's such an invitation for the rest of us. So I think that the compassion is the biggest way that it connects all of us and helps us grow in our relationships. So
that's good. And I agree. I think I got into the Enneagram because someone had, in this like evaluation process my husband and I were going through, they had us do a test, and then they talked to us about it. And then we started kind of reading more about it, putting into practice the things we were learning. And it ended up being the most helpful tool we had ever discovered for our marriage. And I was like, man, I just started telling everybody about it. And then I thought, I'm going to be telling everybody about it. I probably should learn, like really learn about it. So, but just that realization of being in some kind of conversation with my husband or discussion, and we're not on the same page, and the things that used to turn into this cycle of, you know, you don't understand, and just going round and round and round, and realizing through the Enneagram, I can now see, I don't see it from like we see our own perspective, but I know what his perspective is.
Yes.
And so I know what it is that he's seeing in the moment, in the situation, what it's activating in him, his focus of attention. And so then it allows me, like you said, it's like taking that step back and having compassion and understanding, mm-hmm. and being like, okay, he's not trying to hurt me.
Yes.
But this is what he's seeing. It's completely different than what I'm seeing. And so how can we come to a middle ground on this? And it's just, it really, for us, it was revolutionary in our relationship.
Yes.
And then even with people that don't know the Enneagram or don't want to know the Enneagram, you still have the knowledge. And so it helps you walk out those relationships with so much more grace, so much more compassion. And you'll see too, as your children get older, it's been fun now that my oldest is 19 and then the next is 14. And so being able to apply that now to my relationship with my children is just, it's amazing. It's a game changer.
Yeah. I was going to say it is. It's so game changing for all of your relationships, even people that don't know the Enneagram, have no desire, don't know their type, because you understand yourself and how you can come across and your struggles and all that. So I love it.
It's so good. It's so good. Well, I'm really glad that you have written this book and that this book is coming out. I think that getting more of these practical tips into other people's hands is needed. And I'm glad again that it's comes from a faith-based point of view, because there's not as much of that out there. And so I think that's great too. So before we close, tell us how we can get the book, where we can find it. How can we find your podcast?
Yes. My book will be for sale anywhere books are. You can get on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target. It's called The Journey Home, and it releases January 24th of 2023.
Okay.
So coming up in just a few months. And and then I have a podcast. It's anywhere you stream. It's on Apple Podcast. It's called The Other Half. But I have, my landing page is MeredithWBoggs.com. And if you throw a /links on there, it'll take you to everything you can need. There's a couple Enneagram resources. I'll have some more like kind of pre-launch stuff, some more sneak peeks of the book coming up around December. So look out for that. And I would love to connect. So.
Okay, great. And your podcast, you do it with your husband, right?
I do. Yes. And also if you go, it's been quite a while since I've released any episodes. I had a season actually that was set up that I had all queued up that aired while I was on maternity leave. And then I was writing this book and life just got wild. And I know, you know, and so it has been on the list of like, since the summer, I'm like, okay, got to get a new season out. And it's still not
The good thing about podcasts, the episodes are always there. And so if someone discovers it for the first time, it's all new to them. So
yes, that's right. There's tons there, and I'll get you some new content soon. But if you go on there and it's been a while. Yes, it's been a while. So
That's great. Well, good. Well, thank you again for doing this. It was great talking to you. And we will link all of your stuff on here so that everyone that's listening can find you, find your book, and everything else that you do. So thanks again. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much.